Next matter this morning, Janicek versus Janicek. Mr. Loeb.
Good morning, Chief Justice Brown, and may it please the court. My name is Jim Loeb, and I represent Jim Janicek. At the table with me is my partner, Dave Marburger, and our co-counsel, Larry Zuckerman. The issue for this court is, did the legislature take us in a whole new direction with respect to spousal support and reject this court's precedents, or did it codify them? It codified them. Ohio domestic relations courts don't have authority to order payments labeled as spousal support where it is undisputed that the property division or other resources provided to the requesting spouse more than adequately provide enough income to sustain the standard of living approved by the trial court. Before 1991, there were two types of payments that a court could order in a divorce other than child support. They were both lumped under the single statutory term alimony. And those payments divided property and, after divorce, paid sustenance and support. These payments were not spelled out in the statute. This court spelled them out. In a line of decisions culminating in Kunkel, this court said that payments after the divorce that didn't divide property could serve only as sustenance and support. This court also decided that the purpose of sustenance alimony was not to ensure that when the parties went off separately into the future, they had balanced incomes. Before a trial court decided whether to award sustenance alimony or spousal support, the court adjudicated what the requesting spouse's standard of living should be. This court did not limit it to bare necessity, but rather the inquiry was what was reasonable under the circumstances of that particular case for a standard of living. Then the question became, who should pay for it?
In this case, I wanted to make sure I understand the factual scenario as this applies to the law that this court of appeals decided. Mr. Janicek basically gave his ex-wife the cash equivalent of the equity in the company.
That's correct.
And he still has stock in the company, but not cash, the cash equivalent.
That's correct. The court based its decision on the present value of the income that Mr. Janicek would receive in the future to value the business.
And then he, to realize the income and the value from that, has to continue to work, presumably till 71, because that's when the support ends.
That's correct.
And she, on the other hand, can invest however she cares to her sums of money and has the income coming from that.
Correct.
And then the court figured out that her required level of monthly expenses was $15,000.
Correct, except for when you use the word required, well, that was for her standard of living,
yeah,
which included luxuries and everything else.
And that entire $15,000 to maintain her standard of living, despite her roughly $11 million, is going to come from Mr. Janicek.
That's what the trial court ordered, correct.
And she would be completely free to not work. In fact, the court said, we don't expect her to work, live off her income for extras, and get her sole support from what the court determined she needed from Mr. Janicek.
Right.
Okay. And is she able to take her cash, instead of passive investments, buy a company and work at a company just like he works at a company? Is she able to do that with the cash?
Right. They're both capital. So if Mrs. Janicek decides she wants to buy a business, she can do that. If Mr. Janicek decides he wants to sell his business and put it in CDs, he can do that.
I just want to make sure I understood what the court's conclusions were.
Thank you.
Are you urging that we return to the Kunkel decision and try to adopt a test out of Kunkel?
Well, I'm not saying to return to it. I'm going to demonstrate to you that no one ever left it. The legislature did not leave Kunkel.
Okay, and well, when it amended 310518, didn't the statutory language change modify Kunkel?
No, and I'll explain why.
Okay, please do.
First of all, the two statutes aren't direct comparisons because the earlier one was a property division statute and a spousal support statute, although it was called sustenance. When we went to the new statutes, we had a new one for property division, and then we had the combined statute, which was gutted and which became the spousal support statute. But here's what the legislature did. In Kunkel and in all the cases that preceded it by this court defined sustenance alimony as payments for sustenance and support. So for the first time, the legislature used this court's words. It defined spousal support as being for payments for sustenance and support. Those words are synonymous with this court's use of the word need in those cases. And so what else they did was the words appropriate and reasonable, which found their way into the statute, those weren't in a vacuum. Those were this court's words in Kunkel. This court said in Kunkel, the court has to divide the property first and then determine whether an award of sustenance would be appropriate. It's right in the third paragraph of the case. The syllabus also says that the payments have to be reasonable. So it's difficult to conclude that the legislature meant to reject Kunkel by adopting this court's definitions, which came out of that case.
Your argument is that the amendments to the statute codified what had been written in Kunkel. That's what you're arguing to
exactly.
us.
Yes.
And so you simply want us to follow the need statute and conclude that Mrs. Janicek, because she has the same equity as Mr. Janicek and can earn the $15,000 per month or $180,000 a year, has no need of spousal support.
Right. That's exactly right. Because anything that when you have the trial court saying it's $15,000 a month and also finding that she can earn $27,000 a month just from her liquid portion of her property division, then anything that's ordered by my client to pay his ex-wife isn't sustenance and support. And you've got to get past that threshold definition, which is in subsection A, before you drop down and look at the 14 factors and decide whether it's appropriate and reasonable.
How do we deal then with the determination that the trial court has discretion to make these kinds of awards?
The trial court has discretion to make awards which are sustenance and support, but it doesn't have discretion to make awards that are not. In this case, if you look at the court's stated reasoning, it said that because it predicted in the future that Mr. Janicek, as a separate individual, would make more money than his ex-wife, that there was an imbalance of symmetry in income, and that its sole purpose in awarding her the support was so her $12 million property division would grow, because the court said that it didn't think it would be appropriate for her to support herself from her own income. That's not spousal support.
Counsel,
that doesn't meet the statutory definition.
What new law is there for us to determine, and why isn't this just a factual determination? I'm trying to think about what we write here that says, okay, because there was, 11 million? How many millions on each side of the table?
It's about 25 million divided by two.
All right. So there's 12 and a half on each side of the table. Because there's that amount, and because the presumed earning power of 12 and a half million, although if it's in treasuries or CDs, it isn't going to earn much right now, then there's just no need. But if you lower that down and say it's, all they've got is a million each, but he has the ability to make $500,000 or a million a year, and she's going to be a school teacher making $50 a year, then it would be appropriate. I mean, isn't that what the local judge is assessing in each and every case and assessed?
Yes,
we're just talking a difference in degree.
Well,
so what do we write that's instructive to anybody?
I'm glad you asked that, and if I were writing the decision, I would write that anything that simply because it's labeled spousal support doesn't mean that it is spousal support, that it has to be for the sustenance and support of the spouse. So in your latter example, if you were dividing $1 million and somebody was making $500,000 a year at a job and somebody else wasn't, and the division of the $1 million didn't give the spouse who was requesting spousal support enough to fund the court-adjudicated standard of living, then yes, there would be support there. And you'd be correct, but it's not so much a difference of a degree, but it's a fact pattern in each case where you have to, the court has to determine that the payments serve for sustenance and support.
And again, I'm trying to think how we sit here, not having heard all the testimony. We're going to have to comb through this record to determine, is her lifestyle such that there's social pressure to write a big check to the symphony and to the art museum and to all of these other things, or you just can't swim in the social set that she's used to? Do we have to go through and figure all that
out? This is easy, and I'll tell you why. It's real easy. The court, she submitted her request to the court. The court examined it, and the court found that her standard of living, including all the things that you just mentioned, should be $15,000 a month. It's adjudicated. It wasn't appealed. It's real easy. No one here is arguing facts about what her standard of living should be. It wasn't even challenged.
Mr. Loeb, I want to talk a little bit about Kunkel, and I'm not sure I'm satisfied, and I'm listening for your demonstration of why Kunkel survives, but assuming that it does, Kunkel also described marital relationships that were exempted from that analysis, specifically those that were marriages of long duration, such as this, and marriages where one party was a homemaker with little opportunity to develop meaningful employment outside the home, and arguably this one fits that as well. If we go the approach that you're suggesting and consider and look at Kunkel, why does the Kunkel analysis help you?
I'm glad you asked that, because the concept in Kunkel is whether a spouse can be self-supporting. If so, the payment should have a definite termination date. Now, to read that language that you just talked about, long-term marriages, to suggest that the analysis of being able to support yourself doesn't apply misconstrues, I think, the entire context of the case, because the case was about, can somebody support themselves? The language that you asked about, you know, simply means, in cases of long duration, if a spouse isn't self-supporting right then and there, there probably isn't time to become self-supporting. So, for example, if you had a spouse who was a homemaker and is 60 years old, well, it's a marriage of long duration, so in the next 5 years, they're not going to become self-supporting. That's what that language means when I read it. Because, again, taking you back to the definition that's in the statute that the legislature put there, sustenance and support, it doesn't have an exception for long-term marriages in the statute that says, well, it has to be for sustenance and support, except if you've been married for a long time.
No, it doesn't in the statute, but you know, the case does contain language about accepting those kinds of marital relationships.
Yeah,
which is where you want to go.
And it's directed toward not the facts in this case. It's directed toward indefinite awards of support. The court in Kunkel was talking about, should an award be subject to further order of court, or should it have a specific termination date? This case has a specific termination date. So at least that part of Kunkel is not present in this case.
Kunkel also dealt with whether it should be a percentage of income and said that that was not a good idea.
Right, but why is that? The reason was because a percentage of income had nothing to do with sustenance and support. It was just a percentage. It had nothing to do with the standard of living of the person requesting it.
Counsel, if I could draw you back to the standard of living question.
Yeah.
Is that a two-way consideration, not just the one spouse, but both spouses? And if so, what was the evidence in this case about the impact on the ex-husband's standard of living? After the award of support.
Both of them could enjoy the same standard of living they had during the marriage without any exchange of support either way.
And after the exchange of support?
After the exchange of support?
Did that adversely impact the one standard of living that they had before?
No. On either side. Now, I know I'm running out of time, but I did want to at least get to the point of what the statute, how it came to be. I see the zeros are there, but can I take a minute?
Briefly.
Okay. When this court said sustenance and support, the legislature then said sustenance and support. When this court said appropriate, the legislature said appropriate. When this court said reasonable, the legislature said reasonable. And we have the luxury of having some legislative history here. The legislative history, and it can be found, I believe, at 132 in the appendix we provided the court, specifically says, and this is the history that put the definition of spousal support in, said the statute was designed to codify existing domestic relations case law.
But, Mr. Loeb, doesn't the statute provide all the guidance that a court needs without looking to previous case law? There's lots of factors described in the statute. Isn't that all a court need to rely on?
Well, this
the language of the statute.
This court said in Mandelbaum that where a statute adopts words that this court has used, that the previous cases inform the new statutes. So this court's decision in Mandelbaum says that you look at those cases to determine how the statute functions if the court adopts the words that this court has used.
Thank you, Mr. Webb. Mr. Cochran.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice Brown. Good morning, Justices of the Ohio Supreme Court. My name is Jim Cochran. I'm here representing the appellee, Sandra Heffler, formerly Sandra Janicek, with co-counsel Gary Singletary. I will be presenting the entire argument in behalf of the appellee. There is a difference between the way that the two parties look at the distribution of income under the statute. And I think it stems not only from 3105.18C1, but it actually stems from Revised Code Section 3105.11. That very simple statute says that domestic relation courts in the state of Ohio are courts of equity. And I think it's carried on when the statutes were enacted in 1991 under the present statutory scheme. It's interesting to note that there are distinct differences between the two statutes, the one that was enacted in 1991 and the previous statute. Not only are there 14 factors that each trial court has to review before determining whether or not spousal support is appropriate, but there was a change in those conditions as well. In fact, there were 7 additional criteria listed in 1991. There were 4 criteria that were eliminated from the previous statute. So it was no accident that the General Assembly in this case changed the very simple qualification as to how they were going to award support in its statutory scheme. The present statutory scheme states that spousal support is awarded when it is appropriate and reasonable. Those are terms of equity. The previous statutory language, that is Revised Code 3105.18B, said that alimony could be awarded when necessary.
So under your interpretation of the new language of the statute, and you keep throwing the word equity out, you don't believe that just dividing the property is sufficient. You believe that the incomes going out into the future need to be equalized.
I believe that because we have evolved to that point, that the Court of Equity has an opportunity to look into how the distribution of property affects the individuals after the dissolution of the property, and that's
so
what happened here.
Even though you have an even division of property, which seems to be in this case, that the higher-waging spouse owes an obligation to the lower-waging spouse, even if the lower-waging spouse make sufficient money on her own to meet what the court has determined is her standard of living, they continue to have an obligation into the future to give some of their income to the lower-income spouse.
No, Your Honor, that is not what I mean. I think if you look at what the trial court did here and what the 8th Appellate District affirmed was that after the property was dissolved and distributed among the parties, the husband was left with corporate assets that could generate, historically, $3 to $4 million. And in most of the record, the court...
But he had to keep working to generate that, did he not?
Well, he also was 93% ownership of those companies. So whether or not he was the president or not...
If he owned most of it and he kept working, he would generate income. If he quit working, who knew what would happen? On the other hand, the court said, we don't think she has to work at all. She probably won't work at all. She can live off his labor. That's the problem with the equities. You don't have a good argument for equities, in my view, unless you accept your proposition that he continues to have an obligation to equalize the incomes in the future, not just the property division. Otherwise, the equities aren't here.
If I could address your argument, Justice, there are two reasons why I don't feel that that argument is sustainable. One, there is an opportunity to modify this award at any time. The court has focused on the fact that maybe Mr. Janicek would sell his corporate assets and would be in a different financial condition. That's not what was facing the trial court when they made this determination. That could happen in the future, and there's nothing to prevent him from seeking a modification under this order. The second is I would just like the court to look at the simple numbers and arithmetic in this case. The court ordered $180,000 per year in spousal support to the wife. If you compare that to the historic earnings of $4 million a year that the husband received, it's approximately 5% of that income. Now, there is no obligation to support the wife if she has need, but there is the compelling reason of equity to look at the assets that were divided and determine whether or not they were fair or grossly unfair. And in this case, the assets that were left for the husband generated at least 6 times more income
Therefore,
than the assets left to the wife.
And that goes back to my statement that you interpret the new version of the statute to require an equalization or at least a subsidy when one continues to make more money than the other, regardless of need.
Well, Your Honor, I hardly think that a 5% deduction from that income earning potential of that asset really qualifies as making her equal. In addition, if you look at all forms of her income, that is the passive income that she enjoys from the investment scheme as well as the spousal support, her yearly income stream is around $500,000. This is by far much lower than the income stream that the husband was left with after the distribution of the property. I think what the court was also attempting to do here was to prevent the depletion of her wealth that was given over to her in the distribution of the property. Without the spousal support, she would have had to have drawn in on the corpus of the amount of assets that she was given in the distribution of the property. With the spousal support, the court reasoned that she would not have to draw down that amount. And if you look at the trial court's decision, it was very firm in the fact that at the age of 70 and a half for the wife, that the husband was no longer obligated to pay that support. And the reason why was is that there was $1 million retirement account that had to be drawn down as a matter of law. So the court was considering all these factors, all 14 of these factors, that are contained in the statute. I would like the court to simply look at the last two criteria of 3105BC, one, which is subsection M and N. N allows, and these are new subsections in the statute. M permits the court to determine whether or not the person that is awarded income lost income production capacity as a result of her marital responsibilities. Now, as the court pointed out, this was a longstanding marriage. This has been 28 years of marriage. Mrs. Janicek only worked outside the home for the first few years of her marriage. After that time, she devoted herself as a homemaker and a mother to 4 children. During that period of time, the marital assets increased because of Mr. Janicek's work with his companies. But our statutes provide that income that's derived during a marriage should be looked at as equally produced by both parties. So when the court again looked at the way that these assets...
And in Mandelbaum, we were looking at a division of assets, were we not?
Your Honor, I'm drawing a blank on Mandelbaum right now.
So basically we said, you know, if the wife held... even though she stays at home, she helps with all the things at home so he can make more money. That's contributing to his income. But then you divide the value of that and gave her half and said, okay, you get half of what you helped produce, but you still get something in the future. That's the position you think the law takes us, that you still get something in the future even though you've gotten the present value of it divided in half.
Well, looking at subdivision M, which is, I think, what the court's referring to right now. I would also like you to look at subdivision N, which means that the court can consider any other factor that it determines is relevant and would be appropriate in providing equity to the parties. And I think it was those parts of the statute that the trial court applied in trying to balance the equities here. Now, the appellant's argument is based solely on an extension of Kunkel, which, as I pointed out in my brief, I don't believe exists. Kunkel obviously was decided prior to the amendment of the new statute, and in addition, it dealt with whether or not a fixed percentage of income could be awarded to a spouse for an indefinite period of time, and that was simply the reason why that case was reversed. During the discussion in Kunkel, yes, need was also considered. But need was also considered in this case as well. Since our statute has been amended in 1991, Ohio courts have been applying our standards for the last almost 20 years. 12 of the 18 district courts of appeals have decided that in order to determine whether spousal support is necessary, it's important to look at the totality of the circumstances. Four of the district courts of appeals, the 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th, have actually rejected the proposition that need is the sole criteria to determine whether spousal support can be awarded. Need is considered with those other factors that are the 14 factors enumerated in the statute.
Counsel, if there was no need demonstrated, would you get to the 14 factors?
Yes, because as a court of equity, and that goes to the uniqueness of this particular case. Most divorce cases come where the parties don't have sufficient resources to fund each other after the split up. This is an entirely different proposition. These parties made their wealth during the time of marriage. Both of them were going to be left with assets that would satisfy their needs.
And at the time that they separated and divorced, they looked at the pot to be divided, and it was $25 million, and it was divided down the middle. And then what I understand from reading the trial court order is that the trial court didn't feel that it was appropriate for her to have to utilize her investment income based on that corpus that she received and to use that for her living expenses. And while he had the ability to work at this business to take his $12.5 million worth of the division and work and develop it and get, you know, more income than she'll get from her passive investment income.
That's absolutely true, Your Honor.
And I guess that's
really the crux of the case.
It is the crux of the case, but I can't help but think if he died and there was no more income, no more work on his part, whatever happens to the business was not going to be distributed to her, how would she sustain herself?
Well, she has, in this personal case, she has those assets available to her.
Her passive income would have to sustain her at the tune of $15,000 a month, which it can, correct?
Yes, it can. There's no disagreement about that.
Okay. So
I would believe, without interrupting you,
go ahead.
I would believe that would be one of those changed circumstances in which they could go back to the court and seek a modification.
I don't think he'd be going back to the court if he was no longer around.
Well, you're right, Your Honor.
Yeah, I think it would automatically terminate.
Right.
So, you know, short of So it, you would agree, then, the termination of his business, either by death, incapacity, bankruptcy, whatever the reason, that would be the only method for stopping this $15,000 a month, correct?
There were some other conditions placed on that, you know, cohabitation or remarriage.
Okay.
But essentially that's it.
What happened if she increased her wealth in some manner, won the lottery?
I believe that that is a circumstance where modification would also be appropriate under our statutes. But at the time the trial court is looking at that, there's no way to predict how that's going to occur. And so in developing this theory of equity, the court did this. And I'm not sure that in this particular case we can say that their determination was unreasonable, given the fact that the alimony award itself is only 5% of his income, and she was left with a generating asset that generated only 10% of the assets that he could generate. If you want to apply...
So it just becomes an analysis based strictly on the comparative analysis of the income post-divorce. That's what you're looking at, and that's what you want us to look at. That if a spouse post-divorce changes or... Well, let me back up here and say we were talking about they were equal, all right, in the amount of money she was able to generate and the amount of money he was able to generate after this property settlement. We wouldn't be here, correct? She wouldn't be entitled to spousal support.
That's correct.
Okay. What happens 3 months after the divorce, 3 months after the court order, he wins the lottery for $25 million. What is her position at that point?
Well, her position is simply this. When the court looked at what would bring them even after the distribution of property, it was $180,000 a year. Adding on the additional lottery cash would not have an effect on her need for spousal support or her payment of spousal support. So I would say that that would not be a justification for asking for modification.
Cochran?
I believe my time is up, Justices. If you don't have any further questions, I'll conclude my argument.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Loeb?
My colleague said I may not have reserved.
Would you like a minute? Go ahead.
Something very important that I want to emphasize here.
Counsel, before you do that, I'm still... mystified. You said you've got it in the appendix that the legislature was intending to codify Kunkel.
It said it was intending to codify existing domestic relations cases.
And where do I find that? Is that Lisa Wu's memo?
It is at bait stamp
131.
132.
That's a memo from a legislative intern describing her interpretation of what the sponsor testimony was in the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Right, and it's...
Two members of this panel were there that day. And that's the strength upon which you conclude that the legislature intended to codify Kunkel.
No, there's a lot more than that, and I'll make it real simple. When this court used the word sustenance and support to confine alimony, the legislature adopted that as the definition. When this court said it had to be appropriate, the legislature took the word appropriate. When this court said reasonable, it took the word reasonable. If somebody was intending on this drastic sea change in the law...
You're assuming we all read Kunkel.
Well, those words didn't come from a vacuum. It would be a heck of a coincidence that all those words that were in Kunkel, Wolf, and all those predecessor cases found their way into the statute if the legislature was intending to gut it. You know, it would be real easy. If we were here talking about what my colleague talked about, income symmetry or balance, the legislature knows how to do that. In the property division statute, for the first time, they said, you divide property equally. The legislature didn't put that in the spousal support statute. They used the word sustenance and support. They didn't say you use support to achieve symmetry. It would have been easy for them to do that because they knew how to use the words. And the one thing I wanted to get at, my colleague said the order was modifiable. It's not modifiable. There was no reservation of jurisdiction to modify this order. So if all the things that Justice O'Connor talked about happen, my client is down the river without a paddle. Okay, so that's why it's so important that these orders be for sustenance and support. And when the order is not for sustenance and support, and we rely on this factor N, I call it the wild card factor, any other factor the court deems equitable or reasonable, if that's not grounded in sustenance and support, then we're going to have individual judges with limitless, boundless discretion, and there'll never be a reversal of any case unless it's bounded in that language, sustenance and support. It has to, and I don't think the legislature advocated to individual judges to do whatever they wanted under the circumstances.
So, Mr. Loeb, what is the rule of law that you're advocating? We tell every domestic relations court judge that he or she will adopt when they read the Janicek case, if we agree with your position. What does it say? What does it tell them to do?
That labeling a payment as spousal support doesn't make it spousal support. The court has to...
In order to award spousal support, there must be a need on the part of the recipient?
Well, the way that I would write it would be it has to be for sustenance and support, which is synonymous with Kunkel's use of the word need, but it has to be for sustenance and support.
Thank you.
Perfect example I can give you under that wild card factor N, then I'll sit down because I know you were gracious in giving me the time. Let's say the court wanted to use factor N because a wife humiliated her husband during the marriage, and so they decided, well, I think I'm going to give you $1,000 a month in spousal support because you were humiliated. Well, that might be reasonable under the big scheme of things, but it certainly doesn't fall within the definition of sustenance and support. So when you write it,
thank you,
it's got to be sustenance and support. Thank you all.